Governor Scott Walker announced this week that $76 million will be allocated for 113 bridge projects statewide over the next 4 years under the local bridge improvement program cycle. Meanwhile, new weight restrictions have been placed on nearly 200 bridges in Wisconsin, due in large part to the deteriorating state of the structures. We're talking about the state's bridge situation here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Let's bring in Chris Hubbuck now. He is a La Crosse Tribune reporter who covers energy, transportation, and the environment. He wrote the recent piece called Detour, Wisconsin Farmers Cope with New Bridge Restrictions. Chris, welcome to the program.
Good morning.
So what's behind this new weight restrictions that are being placed on nearly 200 Wisconsin bridges? What's going on?
Well, this goes back to 2014. There was a mandate from the Federal Transportation Department that required states to sort of recalibrate how they look at bridges. And this was in response to something that had been going on for about 10 years with the trucking industry. They had developed trucks with more and more axles, and these are the dump trucks and milk trucks and sometimes garbage trucks you see with, they might have four or five, up to seven axles in a single truck. And so they're carrying the weight of a semi in a much more compact package. And what they figured out is that this puts a lot more stress on a bridge than having the weight spread out over a long semi, and they found that it puts especially more stress on short bridges. You know, these are the 20 to 50 foot little bridges that you might not even notice you're going over when you're crossing a creek or something on a county road. So states had a deadline of December 31st to kind of recalculate weight restrictions using this new formula.
And December 31st of last year?
Of last year,
uh-huh.
Yeah.
Okay.
So these just started taking effect, and then that sort of trickled down to the town and county level where they had to put up signs this spring posting the new weight limits on these bridges. There's 184 of them that had their weight limits lowered as a result of this.
Do we know how many bridges the Wisconsin DOT looked at before coming to a decision on the bridges that needed these new restrictions?
Thousands. I don't have the exact figure. More than 2,000 bridges, and I would say that they also found that there were 348 of those bridges where they realized that the weight postings were actually too low or lower than they needed to be, and so they recommended lifting weight restrictions on those bridges.
So where are most of the bridges that did have their weight restrictions lowered, where are they clustered, or what part of the state are these bridges in?
They're all over the state, however, although not in every county, but they're spread out all over the state. However, about three-quarters of them are in kind of the western side of the state, and about a third are down in southwestern Wisconsin in what we call the Driftless area, where La Crosse is. And the reason is really pretty simple. It's just that there's a lot more bridges on this side of the state because of the hilly terrain. There's a lot more creeks and streams to cross, and so there's just more bridges to begin with.
So you talked with some farmers and truckers. What are they saying about these new weight restrictions?
Well, this is something that it's not entirely new to them. Some of the folks that I've talked to have been kind of coping with restricted bridges around their farms or on their routes for a while, but now all of a sudden they've got new ones. Reminded of a guy from northern Trempealeau County. His name is Shane Goplin. He farms about 3,000 acres up there, raising crops, and so he's got farms that are spread out somewhat, and between them, he might have 3 or 4 miles to drive, and he described to me having his main route started as a 4 mile a 4-mile commute, but then when he started factoring in all the different places with weight restrictions, now he's up to 17 miles to get, you know, he has to detour down to Whitehall and then back to get from one of his farms to the other.
That's a much longer distance, 4 to 17.
Is.
Yeah. So certainly an impact there. What do we know about trucks trying to get products to market or you know, just hauling products?
Because a lot of these bridges, almost 95% are on county and town roads. So this hasn't had a great impact on the sort of interstate trucking,
okay,
you know, that you would think of. Those state bridges tend to just have higher weight restrictions. So there's been less of an impact. But where you do see it is with with farmers who have to get their heavy equipment into their fields and then get their crops out of the fields, usually in a semi. That normally could weigh up to 80,000 pounds loaded. And you see it with milk haulers who have to get to some of these rural farms. It has less impact, but it can impact things like, say, a cement truck that needs to get, to get down a road to build a house or to build a building or something.
Talking with Chris Hubbuck right now. He's a La Crosse Tribune reporter covering energy, transportation, and the environment. He recently wrote a piece called Detour, Wisconsin Farmers Cope with New Bridge Restrictions. You can join in the conversation at 800-642-1234. Has the weight limit of a bridge in your area been lowered? How has that impacted you and your community? Was this a good thing? Did it improve the traffic movement where you live, or has this caused challenges? 800-642-1234. You can email ideas@wpr.org. So, Chris, how did Wisconsin's analysis compare to that of other neighbors, for instance, Minnesota, as they look at bridges?
You know, I took a look at Minnesota, and they had more bridges than Wisconsin that they have put new postings on. Although what's interesting and different in Minnesota is that they post three different weight limits for a bridge by class of trucks. So one for these special haul vehicles that we're talking about, the multi-axle trucks, one limit for semis, like tractor-trailer trucks, and one limit for double trailer trucks, like you might see a FedEx truck with hauling two trailers.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's sort of a more precision approach.
Certainly gets more complicated.
It does. It gets a lot more complicated, but it means that only those special haul vehicles are sort of caught up in that new lower posting, and the farmer driving a semi or something like that does not. So I think that the impact has maybe been not as great on agricultural uses.
You write about this Federal Highway Administration deadline to evaluate bridges. What is this deadline about, and what does that work entail?
Well, essentially, it's just engineers applying a new formula and this is beyond my level of expertise, but they have formulas that help them figure out the stress that a bridge can endure from repeated use of different loads, and when you talk about when these loads are compact, you know, you have a lot amount of weight in a very short package affects the bridge differently. And these trucks, you know, I should say that most of these bridges were designed 40, 50, 60 years ago, some of them much longer. So, I mean, there's a few of these bridges that are more than 100 years old. Others are fairly new, but they just weren't designed with this type of truck in mind because these axle configurations really didn't come into use until about the last 10 to 20 years. And so it's just a matter of looking at the bridges in light of the current technology.
Current technology, right. Almost 10% of bridges across the country are structurally deficient. That's according to a report last year from the American Society of Civil Engineers. Wisconsin's bridges are no exception. More than 1,200 were structurally deficient in 2016. We're talking about the new weight limits on bridges in Wisconsin here on The Morning Show. Chris Hubbuck is a La Crosse Tribune reporter covering energy, transportation, and the environment. You can join in 800-642-1234. Has the weight limit of a bridge in your area been lowered? Perhaps weight limit went away. How has that impacted you and your community? Did it improve the traffic flow, or has it caused challenges? Call in, tweet us, WPR Mornings. We'll get back to the discussion after this news update on the Ideas Network. The backlog of bridge rehabilitation tops $123 billion in the U.S. Meanwhile, almost 200 bridges in Wisconsin have new lower load limits. We're talking about what this means here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Chris Hubbuck stays with us. He's a La Crosse Tribune reporter covering energy, transportation, and the environment. He recently wrote about new bridge restrictions, talked with farmers about it. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Farmers and truckers, let us know, how do these lower weight limits impact your work and the routes you take? What do you want the state to do about this? Have you seen more larger vehicles and farm equipment detours near where you live because of lower weight limits on bridges? Call in or email ideas at WPR.org. Let's go to Jimmy joining us from Valley Junction. Hi, Jimmy.
Morning. I've noticed that we have a couple bridges up here in Monroe County that were down to one lane because of damage, and it took months and months for those bridges to be repaired. And so I think we just got to solve this funding issue with roads. Doesn't seem like the governor and the legislature get its act together to actually solve this. And I guess my suggestion would be a sales tax, since more and more people are getting packages from Amazon and different online services. Everybody uses commerce. They're either driving to go to the store or they're getting stuff delivered. So I think that's a fair tax that should be utilized to, you know, add some to the sales tax and get these bridges repaired so they're not dangerous.
Well, Jimmy, thanks for calling in. Governor Scott Walker announced that a list of 113 bridges would be replaced with more than $76 million in state assistance. So, Chris, how many of the downgraded bridges made the list?
It was 8.
And so where do we, when it comes to the cost of repair and getting the jobs done, when is the state responsible versus the city or county?
Well, if it's county, city or county owned, it's their responsibility, but, you know, the money is just not there. I mean, La Crosse County in a average year has about maybe $3 million in its highway budget. Some of these towns, maybe $100,000, $150,000, if they're really spending a lot that year, that's not going to replace a single bridge. They're really dependent on state and federal assistance to do these bridges, but that money has just become increasingly tight. And you know, as you see, with that list of bridges that are getting state aid, that's not going to make a big dent in this particular set.
So how are communities responding to these changes, and what kind of fixes are being considered at the local level?
In some cases, the fix can be fairly simple. There was a bridge here in La Crosse County, a timber bridge. It was on a dead-end road that there were maybe a dozen people live on that road, including some farmers, or at least one farmer and some loggers who were unhappy about it. That turned out to be a fairly simple fix. They were able to add a beam. It's called a spreader beam. It cost about $5,000, and they were able to take the posting off that bridge. Unfortunately, of the other 8 bridges in our county, a study showed that probably there was not an economical fix to any of those. They just simply need to be replaced.
Do we know anything about whether the trucks adhere to these weight restrictions? Do they use the bridges regardless, or do they really follow the rules of the weight on these bridges?
That's a great question. the folks I talked to, certainly none of them told were going to tell me.
They're not
going to
be forthcoming about that, right?
but most of them, I get the sense, are fairly respectful of the limits that, you know, these are the same bridges and roads that they have to drive every day. They obviously don't want to end up with their truck in a creek, because if that happens, that is actually one way that the town or county is off the hook for paying for it, and the person who broke it is on the hook for paying for it. But you know, these guys are respectful. That same farmer I talked to who's seen his commute go from 4 to 17 miles, there was a shorter route in there that he could use, but it was a very hilly, windy town road that he felt was both unsafe for his trucks and just knew the road couldn't withstand it.
Topography also played into that as well.
Definitely, yeah.
Yeah. Let's go to Vern joining us from Wilson. Hi, Vern.
Good morning. Thanks for letting me be on.
Sure.
So my question, just how much effect does this wetlands law have on the rebuilding of bridges and building bridges? Because when they did the bridges and roads out here, they have to get all these extra permits and stuff like that because of the wetlands law.
So there's a permitting process that Vern is talking about in order to repair bridges as well. That perhaps also factors in the time it takes to get the work done. Chris?
I can't really comment on the impact that might have had on costs.
Yeah.
If it's a matter of replacing an existing bridge, if they're not increasing the footprint significantly, then that shouldn't involve taking any new wetlands, which shouldn't need a permit. But certainly if they were going to expand the footprint of the bridge or something, that might add an additional complication.
Chris, as we wrap up here, what are you watching for next on this issue?
Well, I think, really it's going to be funding. And I think, a lot of the stakeholders in this thing, including the trucking industry, and certainly a lot of the towns and counties, see that probably there's got to be some new source of funding, and increase to the gas tax or something of the like. So I think the pressure is going to be on the legislature and the governor to come up with a source.
Well, Chris, thank you so much for making time for us.
Oh, absolutely. It's my pleasure.
Chris Hubbuck is a La Crosse Tribune reporter covering energy, transportation, and the environment. He joined us to talk about his coverage of how weight restrictions on some bridges in the state are impacting those in western Wisconsin. And now a conversation about Foxconn. Midwest Environmental Advocates announced yesterday its filing of a legal action in opposition to a water diversion plan from Lake Michigan for Foxconn Technology Group. Last Friday, the group filed its petition under the Great Lakes Compact to challenge the State Department of Natural Resources' April 25th approval of the City of Racine's request to divert 7 million gallons per day of water outside the Great Lakes Basin. Let's bring in Assembly Speaker Robin Voss to the conversation. He is a Republican state representative from Rochester. Representative Voss, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me on, Kate. Good morning.
Good morning. Well, let's start with the legal challenge on the water diversion. Most of the water would be returned after treatment, but the groups argue the DNR made a mistake by disregarding a requirement that diversions be for public water supply purposes, which they say is defined as serving a group of largely residential customers. What do you make of this legal challenge here?
Well, of course, people have the right to sue, and it's not surprising to me that people who have been against the project from the very beginning and sometimes seem like they're against almost any progress are going to go to court to try to make their case. I think that the Walker administration and the folks who have been working on Foxconn have really done a great job of dotting every I and crossing every T to make sure that we don't do it. So let me just put out a couple facts that many people don't really know. Number one, the city of Racine in 1995 will have used more water than they will when Foxconn is fully operational. So just to make that point again, we will be using less water out of Lake Michigan, partly because of the Great Lakes Compact, but also just because of reduced usage 25 years after that we had the last draw at this level. Number two, the city of Chicago every single day draws out 2.1 billion gallons of water from Lake Michigan and doesn't return a drop to the lake. So the idea of saying that something that is going to still have less water than almost 20 years ago, and at the same time where we allow people in Illinois to tell us how we are doing our environmental stewardship, while at the same time drawing out billions of gallons of water, really kind of flacks, you know, right in the face of hypocrisy to me.
Well, I think these groups don't exactly have issue with the quantity of water being pulled from the lake, but they're concerned about what is being returned to the lake, and also that this works around the compact itself that was instituted a decade ago.
Well, I voted for the compact. Of course, I'm somebody who wants to make sure that we always have access to the world's largest freshwater resource and that we don't do it in a way that allows someone to pump it to Arizona or anything like that. So I certainly support that idea. But let's remember that the Great Lakes governors and premiers from the provinces just approved a diversion to Waukesha, which is about the exact same amount. So remembering that that's outside the basin, this is right in a straddling community, which is specifically put into the compact to allow for diversions like this, which is why I think in the end the lawsuit is going to be found to be frivolous. But at the same time, I respect the fact that they have the right to do it. I just think ultimately they won't be successful because the compact is pretty clear on straddling communities, especially for something that's going to create 13,000 family-supporting jobs.
Well, let's look at another place where we're seeing legal action. That's on the property acquisition front. Yesterday, an attorney representing a dozen property owners in the area in the village where Foxconn is building, they filed an appeal with the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals regarding that federal judge's decision earlier this month. So there are landowners who are holding out, who don't want to sell as Foxconn wants to break ground on phase one in Mount Pleasant. So what is the challenge you see here?
Those are my constituents, and I fully support the idea of saying that, look, no one should be forcing people from private land for use by another private developer. So do I think that they should sell? Yes, I would sell if I were a landowner, but I don't live there. So I don't think that it should be something where government comes in and takes people's private property without just compensation. I think that in the end, the Foxconn development will probably be around that subdivision. Now, I'm not saying I would want to live there because you're going to have an awful lot of traffic and construction and all those things, but I think they have every right to stay there if that's what they want to do.
So what do you say to critics of this who call this situation an abuse of government power?
Well, it's really not, which is why those properties have not been taken by eminent domain. I don't think that they will end up doing so, according to village officials. It sounds like they are trying to still negotiate as much as they are able to do so. I don't believe that they are blighted in the definition of what I would think of or an average citizen would see and say that's a blighted property. So hopefully they'll be able to either be left alone if they don't want to sell or to be able to find a workable compromise that meets their needs but does it in a way that doesn't require going to court.
You have a line to Assembly Speaker Robin Voss, who is with us, 800-642-1234. As we talk Foxconn, what questions do you have about Foxconn? What do you like? What concerns you? Are you excited about the job opportunities Foxconn is projected to offer? Are you planning to apply? 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Representative, what are you hearing from your constituents about Foxconn broadly as you go out there and you talk to people? What are some things you're bringing back?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. I actually had one of our local Democratic officials say to me there has not been this much excitement in Racine since before the computer was actually invented. And I think that's really true. You look at where we are, a huge economic development facility that's going to be built, the largest manufacturing campus in the world. Most of us from Wisconsin know that Racine has been called Invention City. Everything from the garbage disposal to malted milk was developed in Racine by really smart people who formed creative companies. unfortunately, during the 70s and the 80s, many of those companies left, and there's nowhere near the manufacturing presence that there was. So for a lot of us, the excitement of having Racine become, again, an international place where things are made and people get good-paying jobs brings a lot of excitement. One thing that I am amazed at is just the idea of Foxconn coming has now made the Racine County market the seventh hottest real estate market in the entire country, hotter than Manhattan, hotter than Miami, hotter than Las Vegas. So I think we're already starting to see the huge positive effects all across the state as we see hundreds of millions of dollars being awarded to companies in every region of the state and the local economy really heating up as a benefit before it's even begun.
Let's bring in Bob in Clay Banks. Hi, Bob.
Good morning. Thanks for coming on the show.
Sure.
I was curious as to, it seemed like this moved pretty quickly. I guess August of last year was when the word of this got out, and then it seemed like it was really a kind of rushed through. And I was curious as to why that time frame was as short as possible.
Bob is wondering, why is this project on the fast track, Representative?
It's really what the company needed to be able to choose a location. They want to be able to get into the marketplace as quickly as possible. So my understanding is they're already beginning production now of some assembly, not really production, I should say, assembly of products. And they want to be fully operational by sometime in 2020. Well, if you're going to build the largest manufacturing campus in the world and you want to be operational within 3 years, I feel like the legislature did its due diligence. We took several months to put the package together, to pass it, to be able to have all of the thought process go into it, to make sure we have a tight contract with guarantees, clawbacks, so that if something does not happen, the taxpayers are not on the hook for that. So I think it was a good product that shows that if we put our mind to it, we can get important things done quickly, but still do the due diligence that taxpayers would expect.
And in recent weeks, Democratic leaders have held town halls in other parts of the state to talk with constituents about Foxconn. What do you think of these conversations being held by your colleagues on the other side of the aisle?
Well, you know, the nicest way I can say it is they're kind of deceptive in what they're talking about. The very fact that last week there was a wrong story that was put out about Foxconn making some kind of change to what they expected to produce here, and rather than even wait for the reporters to double-check as to the facts, they started to retweet and say this is exactly why they were against it. Now, that was all false. So, unfortunately, my Democratic colleagues, not the ones from Racine and Kenosha, to their credit, but around the rest of the state, are cheering for the failure of Foxconn, which I just could never imagine. If 13,000 jobs came to Green Bay or New Richmond or La Crosse or Madison, I would be the biggest cheerleader because that's what we want for our entire economy statewide to be successful. So the fact that people are hoping that Foxconn fails just points to how hyper-partisan some of these folks have become, because we all know if a Democrat governor had brought in 13,000 family-supporting jobs with an average payroll of $54,000, created a huge new opportunity for other businesses to thrive, made sure that we had the largest foreign investment, one of the largest in the history of the country, they would be crowing about that, and rightfully so. It's a big deal. And I hope that all of us say we should be successful and not hope for failure.
We're talking with Assembly Speaker Robin Voss about the latest developments on the Foxconn project. You have a line to Representative Voss. What questions do you have about Foxconn? What do you like? What concerns you? Are you interested in the job opportunities that Foxconn is projected to offer, and are you planning to apply? 800-642-1234. Tweet us at WPR Mornings. We'll pick up the conversation with the representative after this news update here on the Ideas Network.